I'll note right at the beginning that a lot of this material I actually got out of a book by Norman Geisler called Christian Ethics, an interesting book, but he has one whole section on the subject of biomedical ethics, and much of this I've taken directly from that and then interjected some things along the way. But in our modern world, the medical field has advanced to the point that we have created ethical issues that never used to exist. Artificial insemination, test tube babies, surrogate mothers, organ transplantation, organ harvesting, gene splicing, cloning, stem cell use, DNA testing are all medical realities. The question is not can they do these things, but ought they to do them? That really is what now has become the issue. Society today is divided into two categories, a secular humanist approach and Judeo-Christian perspective. The listing below will explain why they are divided. And you'll notice on the left-hand column is really the biblical perspective. It's called Judeo-Christian, but it's the biblical position. Then on the right, you have the humanist position. And when you contrast these things, you'll see why this is a political issue. Because you have people that have totally a different understanding of how they approach life. For example, the Christian believes there's a creator. The humanist does not believe that there's a creator. Second, man was specially created. That's the Christian view, but humanists believe that man evolved from animals or some lower form of life. Third, God is sovereign over life. That's the biblical view, but the humanist that man is sovereign over life. Number four, the Christian believes in the sanctity of life principle, whereas the humanist believes in the quality of life principle. And last night in euthanasia, when we talked about that, the quality of life is what affects people's arguments as to why they should do certain things. And that, again, is basically a humanist viewpoint. And number five, the Christian viewpoint that the end does not justify the means, but the humanist believes that the end does justify the means. So if some good can come out of it, it doesn't make any difference if you did something that was bad or did something that was wrong. And that'll come out and through some of the things we discuss here. To the secular humanist, ethics is autonomous and situational. Nothing or needing no theological or ideological sanctions. This belief, of course, leads to the following conclusions. We'll come back later and do the opposite of this, but this is the conclusion of the humanist. Number one, humans are responsible for the quality of life. Humanism believes that men, not God, are responsible for our destiny because they don't believe in God. They believe that man determines his destiny, whatever that is to be, that man can control that. Seems to me if they would look around a little bit and see some of the things that happen, whether it's hurricanes, tornadoes, or volcanoes, or whatever it may be, they would realize man doesn't control those things. But they have some kind of idea that someday maybe science can learn to be able even to control those kind of things. Therefore, the quality of life can justify such things as vitro fertilization, active euthanasia, the right to abortion, the right to suicide, the right to embryonic stem cell research. Even genetic improvement of the human race is based on the so-called quality of life principle. If this was true, you could say a baby was not a person until he's at least 3 days old after birth, or even 3 years for that matter. I mean, who decides? If you come out with some reason or argument, it could be any age. Then if something was wrong with the baby, they could justify ending its life in one way or another. And of course, that's the humanist approach. There is no responsibility to God. There is no absolutes. Man is in control. It's a total different thinking. Second, individuals have sovereignty over their lives. Secular humanists do not believe in God, nor that he is sovereign over life. Therefore, man has the right to control his own destiny. Thus, suicide, voluntary euthanasia are defended as moral rights. Abortion also, then, is the right of choice by the mother. This line of thinking follows right down to when life begins. Some will say at birth. Others would say, well, it begins when one becomes a self-conscious individual, which could be nearly 2 years of age. The same reasoning leads to the conclusion that voluntary euthanasia is all right. And it's because they believe man is sovereign, not God, but man. Third is the duty to create a superior race. All secular humanists believe in biological evolution. They don't believe in creation. They don't even believe in theistic creation or theistic evolution. They go beyond that. Their conclusion, then, is that man has a right to guide the future evolution of the human race. And that's honestly what they think they're doing. When you abort a baby or when you practice assisted suicide, their thinking is that somehow they are helping the evolving of the human race into something better. This goal, of course, is genetically engineered humans. Their goal is. Gene splicing holds the promise of creating and patenting new animals. Sperm banks, artificial insemination, and surrogate mothers now make it possible to breed superior human beings, so they think. The goal is to create a superior breed, totally possible to breed superior human beings. The goal is to create a superior breed totally engineered to specifications. Prenatal testing is already opening the door for aborting or eliminating genetically impure offspring. Some have already suggested that where there are carriers of genetic disease, there should be forced sterilization. There's even today what is called chimera, where animal and human blood and parts are genetically mixed, and we'll mention a little more of that later. The fourth one, the end justifies the means. That's what the humanist believes. He believes that only the end justifies the means and nothing else. This is called situation ethics. This is what, to them, justifies the embryonic stem cell research. Since fresh new tissue works the best in experimentation, there is the hope that research using aborted babies could lead to cures for such things as Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's disease, and then, of course, many others. The end, a cure for a disease, justifies a woman aborting her baby. I recently heard David Barton say at a pastor's forum that Pastor Brown and I attended, which was somewhat was quite interesting. He made the statement that there are actually no diseases to this point that they've found a cure for from embryonic stem cell research. But they have found some 65 cures from adult stem cell research. But that goes back, they still want to prove that it's all right to abort a baby. And that's their hope that they can bring good out of that, and yet that hasn't been provable. Scientists even speak openly about growing fetuses for spare parts. In other words, you could cultivate a clone like yourself. I don't know how they would preserve it, but put it on ice or something. So when you get a bad knee, they can simply switch knees for you, and you can go on and just live forever. But that's the theory behind it. And ultimately, you know, they don't say this, but ultimately that is the goal, to the point where they can make man live forever. The environmentalists are going to keep the earth preserved forever. And the scientists are going to create genetically somehow humans that will live forever, and you never die, you never get sick. Wonderful philosophy, isn't it? But it totally disregards, number one, that there is a God, and number two, that man has a sin problem. That's why they have these problems. So it just totally disregards everything. Now, in an evaluation of the humanist biomedical ethics, since they believe there is no God and man is simply a higher animal, there seems to be no logical reason to prohibit any of these various areas of life. We next want to discuss some rational grounds to challenge their presuppositions. Number one, the quality of life principle is utilitarian. The quality of life principle is utilitarian, which means the greatest happiness for the greatest number. In other words, if there's a few that don't fit in, it's all right to exterminate them. The greatest happiness for the greatest number of people. First of all, what does quality of life mean? Is it a physical, social, or spiritual quality? Second, Who decides what quality means? The patient, the doctor, society, or even the government for that matter? Third, which people get this quality treatment? On what basis do we discriminate? Age, race, social rank? Fourth, how do we know for sure what procedure will bring about this elusive quality of life? One would have to be God to know the answer to these things. For example, it might cure one problem but cause a greater one. There's a lot of things they've done that actually is true. Second, we are not sovereign over life, is their argument, that they, man is, not God. What does the Bible say about God's sovereignty? Job 1:21, the Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Deuteronomy 32:39, I kill and I make alive, God said. Genesis 1:21 and 27, and God created every living creature, so God created man in His own image. He is the creator. Acts 17:28, for in Him we live and move and have our being. The sustainer, therefore, we have no right to innocent blood. Genesis 9:6, whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God made he man. Or Exodus 20:13, thou shalt not kill. Whether man wants to admit it or not, God is sovereign over what he created, and man is responsible to him. Besides what the scripture says, there are other reasons showing that we are not sovereign. Number one, it's evident that man did not create life. Life was here on earth before man arrived. Second, in spite of all our medical knowledge, we cannot stop death. And I'll just take a very factual statement here. They're never going to prevent death. God has decreed death. They will not prevent it. But they have the idea that somehow they are sovereign and they can prevent death. Number three, man has not been able to create life. Humans have not created from scratch or from nothing any new living thing. Even with the cloning, they're not making something from nothing. Man cannot do that. Only God has ever done that. Since man did not bring human life into the world, he has no right to claim sovereignty over when it leaves. There is no duty to produce a superior race. The whole concept of a superior race is based on evolution. It does not consider the fact that our imperfect bodies are because of the fall of man and the curse on man because of it. And that's where the problem is. They don't recognize that and won't recognize it. But we know as believers and understand that the reason we have these problems is because we're sin-cursed. When God told Adam and Eve, if you sin, you will die, that has affected the entire human race and still is and will, of course, till the day that God makes us new in eternity. But it's impossible to produce a perfect body that will not die. Even Charles Darwin spoke of a favored race. Adolf Hitler got his ideas actually from Charles Darwin. Julian Huxley, the famous evolutionist, saw man as the business manager for the cosmic process of evolution. It's logical that if there is no God, no creator, and man is a product of a lower form of life, then maybe man can manipulate evolution and make a superior human. The problem with this is that there is a God, and he is the creator, and man is a fallen being. That's the problem. There are several reasons why you cannot produce a superior race. Number one, there's no evidence that naturalistic evolution processes produce the present race. Both the scriptures and even factual science prove that there is a creator and everything was created. Second, science has not been able to improve even a fruit fly. Now, they might be able to treat things, but they've never actually been able to improve anything. Third, even if we could make changes in man, there is no ethical reason for doing so. So why would we do it? There isn't really anything to be gained by it. Number four, even if man could make changes in the human race, how would we know it was better and not just different? Could we honestly say it really was better? Very likely not. Now, the end does not justify the means. Number one, the end does not justify the means. The means must have its own justification. Second, the end in itself needs justification. Not every goal is good. Third, if a good end's justified any means, then killing AIDS patients in order to curb the spread of this deadly disease would be morally justified. Now, there's a thought. A Christian perspective then on biomedical ethics, so we're switching from humanism to what's really biblical. Our responsibility is to serve the Lord. Consider the contrast of the Christian view and the humanist view. The Christian view is serving God. The humanist view is playing God. The Christian view, when we do treatments, it's voluntary. And the humanist would say it should be compulsory. The Christian would work at improving human life. The humanist would work at creating human life. The Christian would repair human life. The humanist would recreate human life. The Christian would maintain life. The humanist would engineer life. The Christian would practice genetic fitness, where the humanist would practice genetic fabrication. The Christian would practice cooperation with nature. The humanist would practice control over nature. The Christian would conform to nature, but the humanist would try to have power over nature, which they're never going to get, but that would be their goal. The Christian approach is to use medical advances to serve the Lord. The believer believes that there is a role for technology to improve human life, but does not attempt to create life. Medicine is used to cultivate, not control, what God has given. The role of the Christian in biomedical areas is therapeutic, not eugenic. And by eugenic, we're talking about creating it, making life. Now, some basic fallacies exposed. Number one, what is being done ought to be done. That's the argument that's used for some of the things that are done nowadays. Is does not imply ought. Just because something is being done does not imply that it ought to be done. Just because it's happening doesn't mean it's right. Just because babies are being aborted does not approve embryonic stem cell search. Just because somewhere in the world scientists are cloning gene splicing and harvesting organs does not automatically mean they should be doing it. So what is being done doesn't necessarily have to be done. What is being done ought to be done. It's not true. Number two, if it can be done, it should be done. That, again, is the argument of the humanists. If it can be done, it should be done. This suggests that whatever man can invent, they should invent. Just because something is technologically possible does not make it morally permissible. It is technologically possible to destroy the human race by nuclear war, but no one would agree that it is morally right. Technological progress is not necessarily ethical progress. It may be ethical regress instead. Third, the argument is used that the end justifies the means, which we've already mentioned, but since babies are being aborted, why not use the embryo to help cure Parkinson's disease? Why not help to keep people from suffering from the disease? Because the killing of innocent human beings to alleviate the suffering of another is not morally justifiable means of attaining an end. So you cannot justify that, even though the end might be good. Number four, two wrongs make a right. Probably heard that a lot of times. It's never right to correct a wrong by doing wrong. Adding a wrong to a wrong does not take away from the first wrong, but adds another wrong to it. For example, it's wrong to experiment on an aborted baby because the wrong of abortion was already done. It isn't actually an added wrong. Now, some basic principles. Number one, sovereignty of God. We cited the scriptures for this earlier. God is the creator and sustainer of the universe. This being the case, humans have no right to seek to control that life. If God created it, sustains it, then we have a responsibility simply to accept that. Second is the dignity of man. Humans are made in the image of God. So God created man in his own image, Genesis 1:27. Man is the crown of God's creation. Human beings both represent and resemble God, not physically, but in other ways. That is why murder is a heinous crime, for it is killing God in effigy. That is why God put capital punishment in the law, Genesis 9:6, whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God made he man. Thus, the dignity of man causes us to realize that such things as abortion, infanticide, euthanasia, embryonic stem cell research, cloning, and so on are wrong. These all destroy the dignity of man. Now, it's just a very simple thing. God creates and forms a little baby. And that is made in the image of God. But when you destroy that by abortion, what you're doing is actually destroying something that God created and God made in His image. And that is just totally wrong. It's somehow just bypassing the whole dignity of man. And we have that dignity because we're made in the image of God. Third is the sanctity of life. Human life has both dignity and sanctity. The former calls for respect, the latter for reverence. Human life is not to be worshipped, but it is to be considered holy. Human life should not be adored as the Creator is, but it should be revered as one of His creations. Humans are not God, but are God-like. Psalms 8:5, "For thou hast made him a little lower than the angels, and hast crowned him with glory and honor." Since God is holy, and we are made in His image, then we are holy beings. No matter how badly human life may be scarred or disfigured, it is still God-like and deserves to be treated as the scarred thing it is. Number four, the mortality of life. Though we may not like it, life is based on a fallen human race, and the consequences of that is death. Adam is told, if you sin, you will die. Genesis 2:17, "But of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, thou shalt not eat of it, for in the day that thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die." Romans 5:12, "Wherefore, as by one man, Adam, sin entered into the world, death by sin, so that death pass upon all men, for that all have sinned." Hebrews 9:27, "As it is appointed unto man once to die, but after this the judgment." Psalms 90:10, "The days of our years are 70, and if by reason of strength they be 80, or 80, yet is their strength labor and sorrow, for it is soon cut off, and we fly away." You can't get away from it. We are all going to die. In short, there are no limits to human life on earth. There are limits to human life on earth. Man is mortal, and human attempts to avoid death or overcome the fact of it are futile and misdirected. While it's not wrong to be treated with medical procedures that may help us to recover things and maybe even allow us to live longer, but the ultimate goal is to realize we're not going to live in these bodies until they're resurrected, and then it will be eternal. So we're appointed unto man to die, and we are going to die unless the rapture happens first. Then number five, charity toward human life. Love is the essence of Christian ethics. 1 John 4:11, "Beloved, if God so loved us, we ought also to love one another." Therefore, it's necessary to apply this love toward human beings in every area of ethical responsibility, including biomedical issues. This love is to be extended to all who are less fortunate than we are. A true believer will love an unborn baby. A true believer would love a dying and suffering elderly parent. I think it's very fascinating, very interesting that sometimes ladies that want to abort a baby, if they can see it somehow, and some of the things they do now are they can actually see the baby and determine its sex and those things. And when they see that, a lot of them totally then give up the idea of abortion, just from the being able to see the reality of that. And to see a little baby and then say, well, wow, that's not just a glob of flesh. You see, that's the love of the individual. God made us to be creatures of love. And that should be a normal response. And that's just totally lost sometimes with the humanist approach. But biblically, it would be treated with love. Which you can take the extreme of that, and someone that's in a nursing home and in their failing years, not able to walk, not able to take care of themselves, but they still deserve to be loved. That's a Christian ethic. They still have the right to be loved. Now, some basic guidelines for crucial issues. Number one, voluntary versus compulsory procedures. With human dignity comes informed consent. Any medical procedure is wrong unless there is informed consent. The patient may be informed about the nature and possible consequences of the medication or operation and must give free and uncoerced consent to it. No medical procedure should be taken with an irrational, unconscious person except to preserve life. A forced cure, no matter how beneficial it may be for society, is immoral. Compulsory abortions to control population are wrong. Forced sterilization for eugenic reasons is morally wrong. A forced cure is immoral. Informed consent is a necessary foundation for all biomedical decisions, including abortion. It's tragic, moral irony, to require consent before a teenage girl in public school can put an aspirin in her mouth, but not informed consent is not required before she can kill a baby in her womb. It's just hard to believe, but it is true. But that's what we're talking about, that there should be informed information before someone is forced to consent to things. Second, mercy killing versus mercifully allowing death. There's a difference between taking an innocent life and allowing a death. The former is always wrong. The latter is sometimes right. Intentionally taking an innocent human life is murder, but allowing a natural death can be an act of mercy. Third, preserving life versus prolonged death. The command in Exodus 20:13, thou shalt not kill, implies we should help prevent the unnatural death of innocent people as well. There is a duty to prolong human life. And if medical or technical aids are available, they should be rightly utilized. This does not mean we are obligated to prolong life. Four, artificial means versus natural means. Every attempt should be made to preserve life, food, water, and air. And we talked about that last night in relationship to euthanasia, that those now are considered medical things when actually they're not. And the reason is so that they have the right to withhold them, and people then obviously will die, simply starve to death. But food, water, and air should never be withheld from the human being, no matter how small, old, or sick they are. Taking away these natural means of sustaining life is tantamount to causing death, which is murder. When technology is available, it should be used to preserve life. However, there is no divine duty to use heroic or unnatural means to prolong human life. There's no responsibility to prolong misery or to fight mortality. Thus, when the sustenance of life is artificial and the process of death is irreversible, there's no moral obligation to prolong life by artificial means. And we did talk about that last night in particular and listed some times when it would be right then to withhold food and water. Number five, birth control versus abortion. For the most part, birth control is not murder. It's simply a method of limiting how many children are born and not a method of killing unborn children. There are some methods of birth control that are actually methods of abortion, since they lead directly to the death of a fertilized ovum, which is a human being. But methods of birth control, natural or artificial, that simply prevent fertilization from taking place are not murder. It should be made plain to most, if not that most, if not all birth control pills contain an aborticide in case an egg was produced and fertilized. And I cannot honestly tell you if there are some birth control pills that don't have aborticides in them. It may be. I'm not a doctor and I'm not a druggist, but generally most of them have aborticides in them. Number six, correcting versus creating life. We live in a sin-cursed world. When Adam and Eve sinned, they plunged the earth into the curse of sin. And we aren't going to get away from that. If a man had not sinned, he would have lived eternally in the Garden of Eden with no sickness or death. Genesis 3, Romans 5, 8. This curse has taken its toll on human health. There are no biblical commands that says we cannot work to alleviate whatever suffering we can. Paul encouraged Timothy to use a little wine for his stomach's sake, and thine oft infirmities, which I believe he was telling him that I think it indicates that Timothy was a total abstainer. He did not drink alcohol. But because in those days they didn't have all of the drugs and things that we have, I believe Paul was telling him, you need to use the alcoholic wine for medical reasons. And there are some things that alcohol can actually aid in the medical areas. I don't believe that's necessary nowadays because we have other drugs and things available, but I believe that that's what Paul was telling him, that there was a purpose for the medication, he should take it. James encouraged prayer for healing in James 5. We must not forget that Jesus healed many people during his 3 years of ministry. Jesus also gave his apostles the ability to heal the sick. Matthew 10:8, there is an extreme difference between correcting imperfect humans and creating perfect ones of our own. Alleviating human suffering due to the fall is a moral duty, but fabricating human beings is not a moral duty. Some basic issues. These were again the areas of the ethics that sometimes is difficult. Since we've already discussed abortion, infanticide, and euthanasia, we will move on to some other bioethics. Those are included in there, but we've not covered them here. Number one, organ transplants. Heart, lung, kidney transplants are now common. Many have had their lives prolonged because of these transplants. Transplantation seems to be in line with biblical principles. Principle of love, first of all, John 15:13, greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. Transplantation should be used as a means of prolonging life, not as a means of avoiding the eventuality of death. Thus, it usually would not be for the elderly who have lived life and would not have the health to sustain a transplant. I'll give you my honest opinion. If I had that opportunity today to take a transplant, and maybe my heart was bad or something, I wouldn't take it. You know why? I've lived life. I'm old enough. I don't care if the Lord takes me home. If I was 30 years old and had five kids at home to take care of, I would treat that differently. But that's just the difference, and that's what we mean here. Simply by age does have something to do with the factor of it. Organ donation should only be by consent. No one has the right to give someone else's organs away. There's also the issue of life and death statuses of the donor. An organ should not be taken until the donor is brain dead. Of course, the exception is when one donates a spare organ such as a kidney. And sometimes that is done and successfully. And number two, genetic surgery. Genetic surgery is now a possibility. The issue with genetic surgery is that it does not restore life as God created, but attempts to reconstruct it in a way that man wants it. Is the surgery correcting or is it creating? Since God created man perfectly before the fall, it seems right that we should try to help this sin-cursed body. There is a type of genetic surgery that is morally wrong, and that is what's known as a sex change surgery. God created male and female, Genesis 1:27. Right now, the biggest area of genetic surgery would involve the preborn babies that have hereditary defects. British scientists are prepared to conduct genetic surgery on an unborn child. They're using genetic transplants in the womb to cure an inherited disease, the blood clotting disease, hemophilia B, as an example. Gene therapy in the womb has been studied for decades. One of the serious concerns, of course, would be the idea of creating designer babies, which that would be ultimately the temptation. The interesting of mentioned there of England involved in these things a number of years ago as a young couple that moved to Milwaukee from Michigan. He was taking his residency training as a doctor at St. Mary's Hospital, and so in the 4 years that they were here, they were in our church and very active. They're now in Bangladesh as missionaries. But they took, I forgot now if it was several months or a year, and went to England. And I was very puzzled. I said to him, I said, Tim, what in the world are you doing going to England for training? He said, well, because Tim's a gynecologist. He said, there's a reason for that. He said, in England, he said, they don't begin to have the restrictions on experimentation that we have in this country. So in the areas of gynecology, he said, they're far advanced than we are because they've experimented with things that we won't allow in this country. And that mentions here in particular, they've done a lot of experimenting, and it's because they have not had the moral ethics that we have had in this country. Number three, sex detection and selection. Nowadays, most expectant mothers have the sex of their unborn baby long before birth. Modern technology has made that available. There certainly is nothing wrong with that. However, there is an inherent danger in sex detection because it could lead to sex selection. There's no way to change the sex, but a person could, by abortion, kill the child and try to conceive again to get the opposite sex. That would be, of course, biblically wrong, as it would be murder. Sex detection, yes. Sex selection, no. Number four, artificial insemination. There are two forms of artificial insemination. Artificial insemination from the husband and artificial insemination from a donor. Sometimes impediments can be corrected by artificial inseminating the sperm into the wife. Now, this is actually fulfilling God's command to populate the earth, Genesis 1:28, be fruitful and multiply. On the other hand, to use a donor sperm takes things a step too far. For a single person, of course, to do this would be wrong because God intends for man and a woman to marry and reproduce. For a lesbian to be artificially inseminated because they want a child is also wrong. It's one wrong piled upon another, actually. First of all, they are living in a sinful lifestyle. And second, it's contrary to the concept of a home with a father and a mother. Fatherless homes are tragedies to be avoided, if possible. For married couples, it's a matter of not accepting the sovereignty of God. It would be far better to adopt a child. There could be possibly a deep resentment by the man looking at a child and knowing it was not his. This is totally different from adoption because both parents would be on equal ground with adoption. Another problem may be that sperm came from masturbation, which is an act of lust. Number five, surrogate motherhood. This is a womb for hire. When a wife is unable to bear children, the husband's sperm is artificially inseminated into another woman other than his wife. She then carries the baby until it's born and is given to the couple where the wife could not bear children. The mother carrying the baby is not the wife of the man who produces the sperm, and although there is no adultery involved, there are serious social, legal, and psychological problems. Sometimes a biological mother has trouble giving up the baby that is hers and has been a part of her for 9 months. It could be very hard for the woman who raises the child to not have in the back of her mind the thought, this child is not hers, but produced by her husband and another woman. There is a danger that this could be done for convenience when a woman wants to keep her job but have a baby too. Surrogate motherhood is no better than harlotry. God created a place for sex with one's own spouse, and God created a place for having babies in one's own wife's womb. If we cannot have them there, then maybe we should consider whether it is God's will to have a child of our genetic offspring. Perhaps there are other babies to adopt, or maybe God wants us to help with the care of the fatherless and not to have our own. Surrogate motherhood is a little too much like playing God. In vitro fertilization is known by the popular expression of test tube babies, but more accurately, it is test tube conception. Sperm and ovum are united in a petri dish and later transplanted into the mother's womb, and is commonly done today. There's one big moral issue involved. When the ovum is fertilized in the petri dish, there could be multiple embryos. These embryos are real human beings. One is transplanted into the mother's womb, and the others are wasted. That's what they say. They don't say killed. This means we are knowingly causing the death of many tiny human beings in order to get one to develop. The end does not justify the means. It is used for the purpose of research and experimentation on humans also is doubly wrong. In some cases, they leave more than one alive. Number seven, organ and tissue harvesting. Organs from aborted babies are used for transplantation. Brain tissue is utilized in treating Parkinson's disease. Other body fluids have medical value. No harvesting should be done without informed consent. We talked about human dignity. A human body is not a chemical factory nor an organic pharmaceutical company. Its purpose is not to produce an organ farm, but as the body of an immortal person who can worship and glorify God, 1 Corinthians 6:19 to 20. While there is no objection to giving our organs after we are dead, it is contrary to our dignity and mortality to keep bodies alive simply for the purpose of harvesting them. The only sense in which harvesting is legitimate is in one-time donor gifts by informed consent after death. Growing embryos or keeping bodies alive artificial for this purpose is a denigration of human dignity. And then, psionics. I remember reading several years ago that a wealthy woman in California, upon death, had her body frozen and kept that way in hopes that someday man would learn how to resuscitate her and bring her back to life. There's no evidence that the person could ever be brought back to life. Here's the problem. The soul and the spirit have left the body upon death. And that, of course, is in God's control. 2 Corinthians 5:8, absent from the body is present with the Lord, which I think indicates very plainly that the soul and spirit go to be with God. very instant that death takes place. Luke 16, 22 and 23, the rich man died and was buried, and in hell he lifted up his eyes, being in torment. His body was back on earth, but his soul and spirit was in hell. Even if you could resuscitate the body, there would be no personhood. This is an attempt to avoid eternity, but it is appointed unto man once to die. Hebrews 9, 27, and is appointed unto man once to die, but after this the judgment. Only God can bring a person back to life, and that is through resurrection. John 5, 28 and 29, marvel not at this, for the hour is coming in which all that are in their graves shall hear his voice and shall come forth. They that have done good unto resurrection of life, they that have done evil unto the resurrection of damnation. Attempts to avoid or deny death are simply not of God. And in cloning, because each cell of the human body has the blueprint for that life, it is theoretically possible to produce an identical twin, not produced by sexual parenting. As you may know, it has been done in animals. As far as we know now, there are serious problems with such animals. Biblically, there are some serious issues. I think it's interesting that the cloning made such big headlines, but presently you don't read much about it. You know why? They're not telling you what the problems are. Somewhere I did read a little article about Dolly the sheep, and before they ever come up with Dolly, there was countless others that they had cloned, but there was things wrong with them. And of course, then they learned that actually with Dolly the sheep, she aged rapidly. So they have not accomplished anything with that at this point. It's really a very dangerous thing. Some things about that. Number one, it's playing God, not serving God. We're to be custodians of life, not creators of life. And again, you have to think in the mind of a humanist. Their thinking is that if you could clone yourself, then you'd have these spare body parts. If you could somehow clone that and then keep it preserved somehow, then when something wears out, your heart goes bad, but they can take the one out of the clone and put it in you, and you're all set to go again for another 100 years. And that's really what they're looking at. That's their hope. So you can understand why they think that way. But obviously, as believers, we can't think that way. We realize that isn't the way life is. That life, we're going to die and someday be with the Lord. But they don't think that way, and you can see the difference. Second, it's bypassing God's plan of procreation by man and wife. And from the very beginning, God created man and woman. He made them to reproduce. They were designed that way. In fact, that's what's interesting, that evolution cannot answer how you came about with male and female. I don't have any problem explaining that. All I do is read my Bible and it says God created them, male and female. That's pretty simple, isn't it? But evolution cannot answer where male and female come from. With everything they try to say, well, you know, this little one-cell thing crawled out of the water and grew legs and all this stuff. But in none of that process do they ever try to show you an evolution of where that thing that crawled out of the water became one man, one woman, or one male, one female. And obviously, it doesn't exist. That's why God created it that way. And third, it's another attempt to avoid mortality by trying to create babies that would live forever. And again, that is their goal, to eventually make man, or make a human being, that would live forever. I don't bother my head about that because I know I'm going to live forever. I know that someday the Lord's going to come back and I'm going to have a new body and just live forever. And what a wonderful day that'll be.